therapist suggested I set a timer every day for 5 minutes, then force myself to remember it in detail until the timer went off. I thought he was insane. Turns out there was something about knowing I would think of it later at an appointed time that allowed my brain the peace of not playing it on a loop. It also meant that I felt in control of my thoughts again. I am so grateful for this wisdom, and I've given it to fellow trauma survivors over and over. I even wrote it into my fictional book, Sweet Girl, as the advice Max gets from her best friend. You really do just write what you know. Chapter 16. The Lie? I Can't Tell the Truth. Do I have the courage to tell this whole story? That's what I'm asking myself even as I type these words. For days now, in moments when my mind is spinning with all the questions and what-ifs, I've asked myself how I would explain all of this. How I could tell you this story. Honestly, I don't want to. I want to keep it close to my heart, to hide it away in the hopes that it will hurt me less if it stays hidden. But then I understand that when things are hidden, we give power to the fear, the negativity, the lies. I don't want to allow that to happen. I want so badly to be honest about our experience, mostly because I didn't know this experience was even a possibility and because I wish I had truly understood. Would it have changed our choices? I'm not sure. But the hope that by being honest about what's happened to our family, we might empower or inform other prospective adoptive families is what has me writing these words down now. I hope I have the courage to include them in this book because truthfully, after building a career based on total honesty, I hesitate telling you this now. But here it is. When I was pregnant with our son Ford, we decided that we wanted to adopt a little girl someday. As Christians, we are called to care for the orphans, the widows, and the oppressed. These are not just a handful of words from the Bible. They are the tenets of my faith. And so we began to research our options and settled on international adoption. Our reasoning, the irony of which is not lost on me in hindsight, was that we were afraid of involvement from biological parents. We were so naive about so many things back then, but our fear was that biological parents might come back into the picture and take the baby back. We reasoned that if we were an ocean apart, that scenario would be impossible. Eventually, we narrowed our search down to Ethiopia. I remember feeling so overwhelmed by the paperwork, the blood tests, the home visits. I had no idea we were at the very beginning of a journey that would last nearly half a decade. So without any real perspective, I planned and dreamed and waited for news from our agency that we were slowly inching our way up the list. We were in the Ethiopian program for 2 years. Toward the end of the second year, we received word that Ethiopia was pausing its adoption program, and our agency told us to consider moving to another country's program. I felt frozen about what to do next. Moving to a new country meant starting all over. New paperwork, new meetings, new waiting lists. I believed God had called us to Ethiopia, and I believed if we were faithful, He would make a way. We decided to stay in the program. Every month, we'd get an email from the agency. Still no movement. The government office that handles adoptions is still on hiatus. No word. 6 months later, they closed adoptions to the United States completely. I felt stunned and unsure. If God had called us here, and if nothing came out of the work and pain and fear, what had been the point? All the dreams I'd had about going to Africa as a family to meet our daughter made me feel foolish in retrospect. For the first time, I asked myself a question that would pop up again and again over the next several years. Should we still try and adopt? Should we just feel content with the incredible blessing we have in our 3 sons? Should we give up? I am not by nature someone who sits long with a problem. I am also not someone who gives up. I started to pray and research and scour the internet for what we should do next. Maybe we were supposed to do domestic adoption. Maybe we'd gone through what we did because we were always meant to adopt our daughter from the States and she wasn't even born yet. That answer felt right, so I researched some more. The more I looked into what was available, the more I believed we should adopt from foster care. We felt called to Ethiopia because they have an unrelenting orphan crisis, and we thought we could help there in some small way. Foster care was the same for me. There were so many children in Los Angeles County who needed love and care. Both were things we could offer in abundance. In LA, you have to commit to doing foster care before you can be entered into the adoption program. At first, we were terrified of what this would mean for our family or how it would affect our boys. Then, we decided that exposing the kids to this reality and showing them how we could tangibly show up for other families who need us was worth it. We entered the system for foster to adopt. What we didn't know at the time was how difficult that journey was. We didn't understand that we'd get foster placement with a medically frail baby and that the department would have no knowledge of her extreme medical need. We didn't know that they would call us 3 days after she arrived and beg us to take her 2-year-old sister, going from a family of 5 to a family of 7 in a matter of days. We didn't understand the delicate dance of managing a relationship with biological parents who were, in many ways, children themselves. I personally didn't understand how traumatic it would be for me when the girls eventually transitioned out 3 months later. I mourned the loss of the foster girls and tried to wrap my brain around what I now knew about this broken system. I thought we'd have months before we got a call for adoptive placement. It came 34 days later. I was sitting in my office at work when I received an email from our social worker. The subject line was, "Twins?" We never anticipated taking twins. We weren't signed up for 2 babies at all. But apparently, agreeing to take on the second girl in our foster care journey had made it possible for us to consider it. We weren't told much about them. The girls were 3 days old, they had been abandoned by their mother at the hospital, and we had 30 minutes to decide. We sat on the phone together and talked through it while freaking out. Newborn twins? Could we do it? Were we ready after so recently experiencing the loss in foster care? We prayed it over. And ultimately, we called the social worker and said the biggest yes of our whole lives. After waiting 4 years for an adoption call, we barely slept that night. We spent hours coming up with names. We were so excited we couldn't eat the day we went to pick them up. At the hospital, I thought I might be sick waiting for them to bring the babies into the room. And then there they were. So precious and tiny and beautiful, I felt like the luckiest person in the whole world because they were ours. Certainly, I knew that in foster to adopt there would be hurdles and roadblocks, but the story we were told about them led us to believe that reunification was a slim possibility. We took them home and didn't sleep for days because, well, newborn twins. But we didn't even care. It was one of the happiest times of my life. 4 days later, at 10 o'clock at night, the police rang our doorbell. What a harsh and shocking sound. I was so surprised when I heard the doorbell that night that I wondered if a package was being delivered. That's how outside the realm of possibility this was for us. The doorbell rang in the middle of the night, and my first thought was, is that the almond butter I ordered? I think that memory is the hardest for me. I mark it as the last moment I still held on to a naivete about how things really functioned in the world we were now a part of. It wasn't FedEx. It was 2 police officers informing us that someone had made an anonymous call to the child abuse hotline about our family for a previous foster care placement. I stood on my front porch wearing boxer shorts with little hearts on them. My mind was foggy from sleep deprivation, and I tried so hard to understand the words that were coming out of their mouths. Over the next few days, I would learn just how common this practice is in the foster care system. Because the child abuse hotline is anonymous, anyone can do it. Anyone can say whatever they want. They can do it for spite, to harm your family, to draw attention away from themselves, or a million other reasons I'd prefer not to think about anymore. I obsessed over them for days, and the obsessing did nothing. No matter what we said or did, we could not escape it. The result of a phone call like that is an intense investigation. Now, let me pause here and say that an investigation is necessary. Of course it is. Child abuse is a horrendous, deplorable crime, and if the system doesn't investigate it, how will they protect the children in foster care? I understand this on an intellectual level. On another level, I had to sit in my living room and listen to someone from the Department of Child and Family Services ask my son's questions about whether or not mommy and daddy ever hit each other when they got really, really mad, or if someone ever touched them underneath their underwear. I tried so hard to be strong for my boys in those moments. I tried to keep a smile on my face while holding an 8-day-old baby and telling them, "It's okay, buddy. Just answer them honestly." When the boys left the room, I sobbed quietly while signing documents that gave the DCFS office the right to pull the boys' medical records, to review their school documents, or to ask them further questions. The whole time, the litany that kept playing on repeat in my mind was, "I am the one who pushed us to do foster care. I exposed my family to this system. I worked so hard to make sure my children would never experience the trauma I'd experienced as a girl. Yet, I'd unwittingly called it down on our family." I had no idea. I was so extremely naive about what could happen to us. I assumed that the worst thing we'd manage would be the trauma the children in foster care had been exposed to. It never occurred to me we'd be attacked simply by virtue of being involved in that world. And I knew, we knew, we were completely innocent of this suspicion, but ultimately our record will show inconclusive. Not innocent, because how can they clearly say we are innocent when they are working with accusations and the child in question is too young to speak? This isn't a system where you are innocent until proven guilty. This is a system where you are guilty until deemed inconclusive. During this time, so many people on social media asked me why I was suddenly so skinny. They wanted to know which diet I was doing so they could try it too. It was because for weeks, we had investigators from Child Protective Services sitting in our living room questioning our character, asking us if we'd ever gotten so upset we'd shaken a baby. "But are you sure, Mrs. Hollis? Maybe when you were really overwhelmed?" I barely ate. I couldn't sleep without taking medication to help me. All of this happened while we had newborn twins. And then, in the midst of this nightmare of pain and confusion, we found out that the girls weren't really available for adoption. Their biological father wanted them. Turns out, he'd always wanted them, and we'd never been told. They were never actually up for adoption. They were definitively in foster care and had only needed placement until his court date. The justification from the social worker when we found out was, well, they could be up for adoption at some point if he steps out of line. The reasoning was disgusting, frankly, but honestly, I can't even blame her. I can't fathom how many children's files come across her desk in a given week. I can't even imagine how many kids she's desperately trying to find a bed for. So if she has newborn twins popping up in foster care and she can't find a home for them, something we later found out had happened, well then, do you reach out to a good family who's licensed to take two at once? Do you mention that they're abandoned but leave out details about other biological family because the alternative is that they don't have anywhere to go? Do you take advantage of a family who is strong and capable because you have three-day-old babies who are vulnerable? Probably. And that's exactly what happened to us. I'm trying to think of how to explain the way this knowledge hit me, and I just don't have the words. We got a call for the twins after 4 years of waiting to adopt. That call felt like the answer to years of prayer. But soon, we were living a nightmare. When they left, I felt cheated. I felt tricked. I felt devastated to the marrow of my bones. But it feels important to tell you that it was ultimately our decision to let them go. Honesty was not always offered to us during this process, which is why it feels so important for me to speak it here. We could have agreed to keep the twins. We could have signed on for 9 months or 12 months or 18 months of foster care with the court-ordered 2-hour visits 3 times each week with the biological father in the hopes that maybe it would turn into adoption. We couldn't do it. Or, I suppose that's not right. We could have done it. But my heart was shredded and my faith in the system was gone. I fought with myself. Every day for weeks, I fought with myself and tried to think of solutions. Maybe if we... But what if they... Maybe the dad would... I fought with God, too. Him, most of all. What was all this for? Why were we here? What did we do to deserve any of this? What about the girls? The ones I named and walked the room with for hours as they worked drugs from their system. What about Atticus with her big, bright eyes? What about Elliot, who was smaller and needed extra cuddles? What will become of her, Lord? I cried. I cried so much my eyes were swollen all the time. I cried when I held the girls. I cried when I hesitated to hold the girls. When I warned myself not to keep attaching to someone I would not get to hold on to. I cried when I saw other new mamas on Instagram. A few weeks before, I had thought we were all part of a tribe. After all this happened, Dave and I felt so alone. Who could possibly understand what we'd gone through? Would people even believe us when we told them we were being accused of something so far beyond reality for our family we didn't even know it existed? Would anyone understand what it feels like to know that some anonymous person was so vindictive they pulled us into this horrific scenario just for spite? Will the people who read this story shake their heads and say, "Well, that's what you get for going through foster care"? It's a mess. It's all a big, hard mess, and it wasn't even finished. Even after the twins left, we still had to endure the investigation. Because it wasn't just about judging us for children in the system. It was judging if we were suitable to care for all children, including our own. Since we'd opened our home, our medical paperwork, our school files, access to friends and colleagues who can vouch for us as parents, no evidence existed to validate the phony claim. Nonetheless, it was terrifying. It was ugly and traumatic, as if we were being abused. We had been attacked, and for weeks and weeks we lived in a state of shock. I've been afraid to write this story. I hesitate to tell you our particular reality because I still believe that the children in foster care deserve advocates. But I think if we had been better prepared for the realities that abuse allegations are an extremely common occurrence, that you might get inaccurate or misleading information about the children, that regardless of your best intentions, your heart might be broken in ways you can't fathom. I think if we had been informed, I wouldn't feel so hurt now. Maybe I could have better prepared myself. Maybe that's wishful thinking. Maybe is the word that plagued me all day long. In the midst of all of the pain and questioning and wondering, we had something big to decide. Would we continue to try and adopt? My gut instinct said, absolutely not. International adoption and foster to adopt weren't areas we felt comfortable exploring anymore, which left us with independent adoption. Dave had preferred this option from the beginning, but I felt like there was a greater need in international or foster care. But now he was asking me to consider it again, and I needed to make a decision quickly. One of the hardest parts about adoption is how long it takes. So even if I wasn't sure about moving forward, I knew that in order to secure any chance for the future, we need to start a new path as soon as possible. Home visits, blood work, applications, hundreds of pages to fill out. It takes a while, and unfortunately, none of it is transferable, so we had to start from scratch. Also, we knew nothing about this world or how to even go about it. Did we go through a domestic agency? Should we get an attorney? It all felt so daunting, especially after what we'd just gone through. I cannot tell you how incredible my husband was during this time period. If you ask most adoptive couples, they'll tell you that the wife originally came up with the idea. Men statistically struggle with the concept of adoption at first. Certainly, there are exceptions to the rule, but most of the time, women are the ones who push for it. I was the one who pushed for international adoption, and later, I was the one who urged him to consider foster to adopt. Now, I was wrung out and incapable of feeling hopeful, but Dave encouraged me to reconsider. I'll remember that conversation for the rest of my life. I sobbed in the backyard where the kids couldn't hear us while he fought for our dream of having a daughter. Yes, it's hard, but our dream didn't go away because it got hard, Rachel. We're going to have a daughter, even if it takes longer. The time will pass anyway. We can't give up. It was Dave who did the research on an adoption attorney. It was Dave who called friends and colleagues and doctor's offices to get referrals on where we should go. It was Dave who sat on the floor while I typed the first draft of this chapter. He had paperwork spread out in every direction on the first day of his holiday break while he uploaded document after document to our new adoption agency. The independent adoption process felt more daunting to me than anything we'd done before. In that process, a birth mom chooses you to be the parents of her child, which means being in competition with thousands of couples all over the country. It also meant that whenever a mother came up who had criteria that matched with ours, I would get a call from our attorney who then asked us to call a stranger and have the most surreal conversations. This happened 3 times in the first 2 months. I think the optimistic view should have been that we had 3 opportunities in such a short time, but the truth, because I'm trying to be totally honest with you, is that those experiences felt brutal. I know I shouldn't have gotten my hopes up, but it was impossible not to get excited when I spoke to a birth mom. I'd hear about her due date and listen to her story and start to think, oh my gosh, what if this is the one? What if we have a baby in April? When we weren't the family she chose, I'd feel foolish for being hopeful. I'd wonder if this was all a big waste of time or a painful experiment that led nowhere. Were we ever going to have a daughter? Should we even still want one? I'd wonder. And my sadness. Was it disrespectful to be sad when I had 3 beautiful boys and other families didn't have any? I would sit in our bathroom and cry while my mind spun with all of these questions. I never truly found answers. What I did cling to was faith. Sometimes that faith was tenuous, as though I could barely hang on to it. But it was still there, that small voice that urged me to keep trying. "Just one more step," God would whisper. "Tomorrow will be better," Dave would tell me. "Someday I'll hold my daughter in my arms and I'll understand why I waited for her," I reminded myself over and over again. During those months that we waited, I walked in faith. My steps weren't bold or filled with the bravado I'd had at the beginning of the journey nearly 5 years before. My faith walk became cautious and unsure. I blindly stumbled my way down a path I could not see. I chose to move forward because while I knew I would find pain, I also knew I would draw strength. I could look at the 6 months prior or 5 years in total and choose to be angry. Or I could look at the whole long journey and recognize all that we'd been given. We knew about the orphan crisis, both domestic and international. We donated time and money and prayer and resources to helping with something that wasn't even on our radar before. That is why I kept walking in faith. We got to know and love 4 little girls, and even if we never see them again, our lives are better because we were connected for a time. That is why I kept walking in faith. We built a stronger marriage. If you go through that much together, it will either make you stronger or break you apart. Dave and I sat in a foxhole of paperwork and interviews and blood tests and invasive questions. Later, we learned how to care for toddlers with severe trauma and newborn twins who screamed all night. We have laughed and cried and come out the other side braver, bolder, and more connected. That is why I kept walking in faith. I can think of so many good things that came out of all that happened, which gives me the courage to take another step. It's why I kept calling birth moms, even if it meant being disappointed when it didn't work out. It's why I kept praying for our daughter, not knowing who she was or how long it would take us to meet her. It's why I'll stay hopeful, even when I'm feeling weary. It's why I'll keep telling our story, even when it's painful to talk about, because at the end of all of this, I don't want you to see someone who went through a long, intense process to adopt a little girl. I want you to see someone who kept showing up again and again, even when it was tearing her apart. I want you to see someone who kept walking in faith because she understood that God's plan for her life was magnificent, even if it was never easy. And even if it wasn't easy, she was bold and courageous and honest, even when the truth was hard to share. Things that helped me. Number one, taking the plunge. Finding the courage to be honest about who you are or what you're going through is like throwing yourself into the deep end of the pool and fighting to swim once you hit the cold water. It won't necessarily be pleasant, but once you're in, it's done. The longer you live in a state of honesty, the easier it becomes to simply exist there all the time. Number two, seeking out other truth tellers. Surround yourself with people who've also gone through the hardship of being honest about their feelings. They can talk to you about how it felt and how they found the courage. They can also stand as an example of someone who admitted their hardship and lived to tell about it. Number three, researching stories similar to my own. If we had done more advanced research into foster care in LA, what happened wouldn't have been so shocking to us. Having walked through it now and knowing more people who have to makes us realize how common our experience was. During the process, we felt so alone, and seeking out a community who understood our path would have helped so much. Chapter 17. The lie? I am defined by my weight. When people talk about divorce, they use words like irreconcilable or messy. But those words are too light. too easy for the destruction of a family. Divorce is a book falling onto a house made of Legos. It's a cannonball shot over the bow that crashes through the deck and sinks the other ship. Divorce is destruction that starts at the top and breaks everything apart on the way down. So no, messy isn't the right adjective. Horrible, ugly, hateful, annihilating, these are closer. When I was 16, my parents were in the middle of a horrible, ugly, hateful, annihilating divorce that had been on again, off again since I was 9 years old. During this season, the final death throes of their relationship, I had just received my driver's license and a hand-me-down car. It was a 1989 Suzuki Samurai, and it was also a stick shift, something I had no earthly clue how to operate. It sat for weeks in the driveway collecting dust, an eyesore of a reminder that it wasn't being used and that I wasn't capable of operating it. I hinted to my older sister, to her boyfriend, and to my mother, hoping that someone would take me out on a weekend or an afternoon and explain the intricacies of operating a clutch. If I knew how to drive that car, I could get myself to school. If I knew how to drive that car, I could get a job and start saving money. So many possibilities existed on the other side of that manual transmission. One day, out of nowhere, my father decided he would be the one to teach me how. And even then, amid the excitement of wanting to know how to drive myself around, I knew that this was a catastrophically bad idea. Daddy had a hair-trigger temper. It was an ever-present part of my life growing up, but during this time period, it was so much worse. We were only a little over a year and a half removed from the death of my big brother, Ryan. In retrospect, I can see that my father was struggling for normalcy, that he was trying to parent the only child he had remaining at home. He was also trying to teach me to drive stick shift in my brother's car, the hand-me-down made possible because Ryan didn't need it any longer. What must that have felt like for him, or for any of them who had hesitated to take me out driving in Ryan's car? Had Daddy drawn the proverbial short straw? Was he the only one strong enough to move past the pain and do what needed to be done? Perhaps another person would have battled their emotions in a different way. Perhaps my mother would have cried or my sister would have lashed out, but my father? His strong emotions tended to bubble in only one direction, straight to the boiling point. I didn't understand any of my pain or trauma at the time. Likewise, I was 16 and couldn't fathom why my father was so angry. We'd driven to the outskirts of town where I could practice without cars around. I can still see us on that abandoned country road as he screamed commands into the air between us. Clutch! Shift! Gas! How many times are you going to stall out before you get this right? The more he screamed, the more I stalled. The more I stalled, the more I cried. The more I cried, the angrier he became. I have no idea if that episode lasted for 10 minutes or an hour. I only know that I retreated further and further inside myself until I was shaking. He finally demanded to drive. We rode home in tense silence. As an adult, I can understand now how hard he battled his temper with us kids and how upsetting it was for him to lose it. An executive, a pastor, and later a PhD, he was utterly competent out in the world, but often at a loss at home. I can see that now. As a child, I was blind to it all. I spent most of my life in fear of upsetting him. In a situation like this, where I had well and truly failed and he was so, so angry, I wished, not for the first time, that I was the child he'd lost. He dropped me off at home and I found myself in an empty house, scared and confused and sick to my stomach. Then I walked into the kitchen. I come from a long line of emotional eaters, so my first thought was that something in that kitchen would surely make me feel better. I found an unopened box of Oreos, and I pulled out two. They tasted so good, I had another. I remember sliding down to the floor alongside the cabinets with a box in my hand. I'd been here plenty of times before. Food is an easy companion. Food has never let me down. Only this time, something shifted. With each cookie I ate, I cried harder. Then I ate more. At some point, the noise in my head shifted. It stopped being about my dad and why he was so angry. I thought about myself and all the ways and reasons that I was wrong. Good, I thought. Eat them all. Eat every last cookie. Eat everything in this room. Eat until you're ugly and worthless and the outside finally matches the inside. I sat on that floor and I cried and I ate until I was sick. That was the first time I remember punishing myself with food. But it wouldn't be the last. My issues with my body, the way I saw it and subsequently myself by association, didn't start that day. But I do think that they took a flying leap from something that may have affected me peripherally to something that became front and center in my life. My weight was no longer just a part of me, like hair or teeth. Now it was something that defined me. It was a testament to all the ways I was wrong. Later on that same year, I got mono. I wish I could tell you that it was because I had an intense makeout session with a teenage vampire, but in fact, I caught it from some water fountain outside Honors Chem. I was bedridden for a week and could barely swallow, let alone eat anything. When I emerged from the haze of sickness, I'd lost a massive amount of weight. I was so very tiny. I couldn't stop staring at myself in the mirror. I wanted to buy new jeans in this new size. I was positive that my life was now going to be everything I'd ever hoped for. I would be popular. I would go to parties. I would attract the attention of Edward Cullen. I mean, as a size 2, anything is possible and everything is likely. I vowed on my soul that I would not gain a single pound back. But I was hungry. I was so stinking hungry all the time. I know they say nothing tastes as good as skinny feels, but I assume that's because they've never had a Nacho Bel Grande. I gained the weight back, and then some. When I moved to Los Angeles at age 17, I was hyper aware of how out of place I was as a size 10, and I vowed that geography was really the only thing that had held me back. I was ready to get a gym membership, run a marathon, and eat only salads from there on out, none of which happened. A lifetime of stress eating meant that I gained even more weight after my move. I decided to try diet pills. I don't even know what brand they were or where we got them, but for a couple of months, my roommate and I lived off of diet pills and Slim Fast shakes. It totally worked. I trimmed down and loved everything about my new, smaller body. Sure, I was hungry all the time and I felt jittery nonstop, but I looked awesome in my jeans. I expected that life would pick right up and be easy before long, and my dreams would soon manifest and become true. I noticed that more men were checking me out, to the point that the attention was starting to really bother me. Anywhere we went, I could feel their eyes staring at me. I expected guys to charge the table any time we went for dinner. I gave dirty looks to any male within a 10-foot radius. I was not totally sane, but I also wasn't self-aware enough to realize it. One day, I got home from work early, and I happened to look out the apartment window. Across the way, I saw two iguanas sunning themselves in the window of someone else's condo. Two iguanas, the length of my femur, just hanging out in the kitchen window. One of them turned his head slightly, caught my eye, and stared me down. You're going to think I'm making this up, but I swear on my life, I thought that lizard was looking into my soul. I was entranced. I couldn't stop staring. I watched those things for what felt like hours, and I became certain that if I didn't keep staring back into his eyes across 100 feet of space, something bad would happen. At one point, I remember thinking, when was the last time I saw a human being? Are these iguanas and I the only creatures left on Earth? My roommate found me like this later that afternoon. When I tried to explain to her what I was feeling, as rationally as I could for someone who had just stared down lizards for hours, she asked, "Do you think it could be the diet pills?" Well, now, I was so grateful to discover that there were more beings on Earth than just me and the lizards who'd survived the apocalypse. I ran and grabbed the bottle and read the label for the first time. May cause extreme paranoia was side effect numero uno. Blessed assurance. I stopped taking the pills and started eating solid food again, and just like every other time, the weight piled back on. I wish I could tell you that extreme paranoia slash lizard Armageddon would have been the end of my career in weight obsession or yo-yo dieting, but I can't. I tried all sorts of crazy things. Susan Powder, Suzanne Summers, Adkins, Lean Cuisines, Juice Cleanses, Master Cleanses, the list goes on. And every single time I would start on a diet and inevitably slip up. One mistake, like having a piece of cake at a birthday party, would signal total annihilation to my brain. One piece of cake meant I might as well eat the entire cake, plus the chips and the dip and the pizza and anything else I could get my hands on. I'd restart that same hateful binge session that I'd learned at 16 in the kitchen with the Oreos. I had identified at a very early age that women who were thin were beautiful. Thin women would fall in love and have handsome husbands. They would also have career success, make good mothers, and have all the best clothes. I don't know that I ever said those words aloud, but I absolutely believe them. 16 years later, this isn't a truth I'd like to admit. I don't like to talk about my messy childhood, or my negative self-talk, or the ridiculous lies I used to believe. I don't like to focus on the things I got wrong, but they're like that little crack in the side of a teacup, an imperfection you only see when you hold it up to the light. The imperfections cover the surface of my life. They help me tell my story. For good or bad or worse, they're part of me. Later on, when I went through my first pregnancy and subsequent weight gain, this struggle became so much worse. I wanted so badly to be like celebrities I saw in magazines who had a baby and then left the hospital in pre-pregnancy jeans. I held on to those 20-plus pounds of baby weight for a year. And the second I started to make headway on them, I got pregnant again. I wondered if I would ever get out from under the pounds. I think this is the part in the typical inspirational and motivational book where the author would tell you that a journey of self-discovery and a lot of therapy helped her learn that weight did not define her. This is where I should tell you that I am worthy and loved as I am. This is absolutely true, but that's not where I'm headed with this chapter. That isn't the kind of book I want to write. Here's what I can tell you truthfully about diet and exercise and weight and what it means in my life. Who you are today is incredible. You have so many wonderful qualities to offer the world, and they are uniquely yours. I believe your Creator delights in the intricacies of you, and He is filled with joy when you live out your potential. I also believe that humans were not made to be out of shape and severely overweight. I think we function better mentally, emotionally, and physically when we take care of our bodies with nourishment, water, and exercise. The lie I used to believe was that my weight would define me, that it would speak volumes about who I was as a person. Today, I believe it's not your weight that defines you, but the care and consideration you put into your body absolutely does. Because I work in media, and because I've had years of accidentally upsetting people online without ever meaning to do so, I already know that my saying this will annoy some people. I can already imagine the emails I'll get, the list of reasons why you or someone you know is justifiably obese, the trauma you've lived through, in some cases, food is your coping mechanism. Or maybe I'll hear the opposite. Maybe you have an eating disorder like anorexia. You're thin, but totally unhealthy because your body doesn't get the nutrients it needs. Or maybe you drink every single day because you're a single parent, or you're walking through a hard season. All of these things are justifiable. All of these are valid reasons to negate caring for yourself for a time. Childhood trauma is not a life sentence. Extreme emotional pain doesn't guarantee emotional pain for the rest of your life. I know this is true because I am a living, breathing, flourishing example of someone who chooses to rise above the trauma of her past. The reason I know this is true is because the world is filled with people who have it so much harder than me and so much harder than you, yet they show up for their lives every single day. You can choose whether or not to stay there. You can choose to continue to abuse your body because it's all you know. You can choose to live in that place because it's the path of least resistance. You can choose to settle for a half-lived life because you don't even know there's another way. Or perhaps you have no idea how to pull yourself out of it. But please, please stop making excuses for the whys. Please stop telling yourself that you deserve this life. Please stop justifying a continued crappy existence simply because that's the way it's always been. Just as you've chosen to stay in this place for so long, you can also choose to get yourself out of it. You need to be healthy. You don't need to be thin. You don't need to be a certain size or shape or look good in a bikini. You need to be able to run without feeling like you're going to puke. You need to be able to walk up a flight of stairs without getting winded. You need to drink half your body weight in ounces of water every single day. You need to stretch and get good sleep and stop medicating every ache and pain. You need to stop filling your body with garbage like Diet Coke and fast food and lattes that are 1.5 million calories. You need to take in fuel for your body that hasn't been processed and fuel for your mind that is positive and encouraging. You need to get up off the sofa or out of the bed and move around. Get out of the fog that you have been living in and see your life for what it is. Does your Creator love you as you are? Yes, but He gave you a body with all of its strengths and even its weaknesses as a gift. It is an offense to your soul to continue to treat yourself so badly. So no, this isn't the book where I tell you that the answer to your struggle with weight loss is to love and accept yourself as you are. This is the book where I tell you that if you truly want to practice self-love, you'll start with your physical body and do the work to figure out why this is an issue in the first place. Do you think I'd understand my emotional eating if I hadn't done years of therapy to get to the bottom of it? Do you think I'd so easily share the story of that day with the Oreos if I hadn't done everything in my power to step out of that shadow? Do you think I magically figured out how to lose weight after a lifetime of living off cheese and gravy? No, I had to work. I had to study and go to therapy. I had to try out different workouts until I found some I love. For me, it's long-distance running and weight training. I had to fight the urge to binge when I made slight deviations from healthy eating, and this habit took me years to adopt. I had to teach myself new coping mechanisms for stress. Sex is a win-win for everyone, for example. I had to figure out how weight loss works and discover that it's actually the simplest thing in the world. A million diets exist based on the idea that if they can confuse you or make you think there is an easy way out, then you'll buy whatever they're selling. The truth is, it's the same now as it always has been. If the calories you consume in a day are fewer than the calories you burn off in a day, you will lose weight. The end. Figuring out healthy meals that taste good to you or workouts to try, that might be tougher. But don't let the media fool you into believing that this is complicated. Learning to be healthy when you've never done it before might be hard if you've got a lifetime of habits to break. But the mechanics of it are actually very simple. And the version of you that's healthy and well cared for is worth every minute of that work. Things that helped me. Number one, mantras. In my first fiction book I ever wrote, the main character walks around everywhere she goes reciting a mantra. I am strong, I am smart, I am courageous. She's nervous and unsure of herself, so she says it over and over all day long. That book is based on my early days in Los Angeles, and that mantra is based on exactly what I used to say to myself daily. A lifetime of believing that your value, or lack thereof, is determined by your body or your face or your whatever means that you've got a lifetime of negative talk in your head playing on repeat. You need to replace that voice with something positive. You need to replace that voice with the opposite truth, the thing you most need to believe. So come up with a mantra and say it to yourself 1,000 times a day until it becomes real. Number two, editing my media. If you're struggling to live up to a certain standard, if it seems as though everywhere you turn you see a gorgeous size zero model with perfect glossy hair, and if every time you see this stuff it depresses you or gives you anxiety, then stop consuming that type of content. Unfollow the models on Instagram. Stop looking at those pages on Facebook. Surround yourself with positive, uplifting role models who focus on being strong and healthy. I'm not saying women who do makeup tutorials or Instagram fitness models are bad. I personally love those chicks. But there are seasons when following them doesn't make sense. Be smart about it. Number three, preparation. You have to prepare in advance for anything you want to do well, period. You want to make sure you get in a workout tomorrow? Then you need to pack your bag today and schedule exercise in your calendar. You want to make sure you reach for healthy snacks instead of your kids' goldfish crackers? Then you better take some time at the start of the week and meal prep some wholesome snack options. If you wait until the last minute, you are not likely to achieve anything. You want to accomplish a healthier life? Map out how you'll get there. Chapter 18. The Lie. I Need a Drink. The first time I ever had a drink of alcohol, I was 15 years old. It sounds pretty scandalous, but honestly, it was basically harmless. My big sister Christina let me have a sip of her Midori Sour one night when I was spending the night at her apartment. She made it in a plastic tumbler that came with the purchase of Big Gulp circa 1998. So we were keeping it way classy. The drink itself was sweeter than Pixie Sticks powder and a shade of neon green that is typically only found in something radioactive. I was excited to try it out because it made me feel mature, but it certainly wasn't a gateway drug to partying at Studio 54. The second time I had a drink, I was 17 years old. My best friend Kim and I drank half a bottle of cheap tequila between the two of us. It was the color of maple syrup, the kind of high-quality liquor reserved for idiot teenagers and sailors on shore leave. We threw up everything that wasn't permanently attached to our insides, positive we were going to die. It's a miracle we didn't. It's also a miracle that neither of our mamas found out and murdered us in cold blood. Those first two experiences are pretty solidified in my memory because they were so out of the ordinary. Alcohol was never present in my late teenage years and only made a rare appearance in my early 20s. Oh, sure, I had some Boone's Farm just like every other poor, confused, college-age girl, but drinking wasn't on my radar. On my wedding day, I had a few sips of champagne. On our honeymoon, I probably tried some kind of blended drink, but that was really more for the milkshake quality than any medicinal aspects. In fact, I remember going to a dinner party not so long into our marriage, and another couple talked about how much wine they consumed. Dave and I drove home talking about it. "Did you hear how much wine she says she drinks? That's crazy." I sat atop my glass house and judged a behavior I couldn't understand. Then I had kids. Then I had kids, and wine became my best friend. Cocktails? They were like favorite cousins you only see on the holidays, which is to say, I only really got to enjoy them on special occasions. Is it funny or depressing to admit that before I had kids, I never really understood why anyone drank? Then, suddenly, I found myself exhausted, overwhelmed, and on edge. I discovered that I could have a glass of wine that magically muted the edges. When my older boys were toddlers, drinking became a regular part of my routine. I'd come home from work, change into my pajamas, because bras are the devil's work, and pour myself a glass of wine while I got dinner ready. When I was a teenager, I watched Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and fell in love with Elizabeth Taylor and Paul Newman fighting their way through a southern plantation. In the film adaptation of that play, Brick has become an alcoholic, and in one scene in particular, he's fighting with Big Daddy, played impeccably by Burl Ives, and arguing that he needs a drink. He keeps talking about a click that happens when he drinks enough that makes him feel better. My teenage self thought Paul Newman was really overselling it, that the description of that click was Southern dramatics. But then I started drinking wine in the evening when I got home from work. Without realizing it, I counted my way toward that click with every sip of white wine. Between the first swallow and the fifth, I feel myself start to relax. By the tenth sip, I was totally calm, able to parent my children better and more easily. One glass of wine at night turned into two glasses of wine at night. Two glasses of wine a night turned into a 7-day-a-week habit that increased in quantity on the weekend. Each morning, I would wake up feeling a little queasy or have to take ibuprofen to counteract my headache. Each morning, I would chalk it up to hormones or lack of sleep. I refused to acknowledge my daily hangover for what it was. At social gatherings or work events, I would pound a cocktail or a glass of the signature drink as soon as I got in the room. Being in a crowd made me hyper-aware of getting it right. I reasoned that if I was more relaxed, I'd be better able to carry on meaningful conversations. Alcohol gave me courage. It gave me the courage to parent. It gave me the courage to have conversations with strangers. It gave me the courage to feel sexy. It washed away things like anxiety, fear, frustration, and anger with juicy acidity and a balanced flavor profile. I'm trying to remember the moment I realized how unhealthy all of this was for me, and I don't have a clear defining instant in my mind. I only recall that one day I suddenly caught myself saying, "I need a glass of wine." As a writer, I pay a lot of attention to words. In this instance, on this random day, I caught the word need. Need implies that something is essential, necessary. So when had I gone from thinking wine might be a nice addition to my night to believing it was essential for my survival? The idea was terrifying. Terrifying because I come from a long line of alcoholics and I didn't want to become one myself. I stopped cold turkey, gave up any kind of alcohol for as long as it took me to realize I didn't actually need it. After about a month without any alcohol, and after discovering that the world would continue to spin on its axis even without it, I felt more in control. I would occasionally have a drink, but truly didn't feel the desire to drink when I was stressed. And then we had foster kids. That summer, we signed up for the foster-to-adopt system in LA County. We jumped right in. In retrospect, we were so euphoric about